Epilogue. Into the sunset. I didn't always drink red wine. Somehow, over the years, a glass of nice red became part of my image, and I admit I played along with it. But I sure as hell didn't grow up with red wine, or much of any wine at all, except a communion. A glass of red sitting on the bar at Annie's Cafe would have been a very strange sight. In my younger days, I was a beer drinker, the crisp German-style lagers that we grew up with in our part of Ohio. That was all right for a while, but once you start to get a little older, beer just fills you up too much with all of its carbonation. Too much bloat. So then, as a young professional, I switched to old fashions. I wasn't a fan of hard liquor on its own, but the sugar and the bitters helped take the bite out of the bourbon, and you could sip on a good old-fashioned for a long time. But if you've got a long night ahead of you, you usually find that drinking liquor for several hours is pretty much unsustainable. Plus, nothing sweet can be good for you in the long run. And so I settled on wine. Drinking wine is a marathon, not a sprint. And it makes sense for the more mature drinker. Once I got to Congress and started going to those receptions they throw almost every night in D.C., I found I could make a glass or two of wine last the whole night. It was enough to take the edge off after a long day. And then I could still go to bed by 10 and wake up ship-shape the next morning. Over the years, I've come to know a thing or two about good wine. I don't know that I call myself an expert, but I do know what I like. Merlot was a favorite, but I appreciate plenty of other types, or varietals, if they're real experts, eh? A Cabernet Sauvignon can do the trick nicely. Chianti is generally underrated. One of my go-to bottles at Trattoria Alberto, my favorite restaurant on Capitol Hill, is the Rufino Reserva Ducale Chianti. It goes great with veal a la Bainer, a delicacy based on a German dish I had growing up that the folks at Alberto were kind enough to make for me and eventually put on their menu. It's a lightly breaded thin piece of veal with two fried eggs and anchovies on top. Delicious. Apparently it went off the official menu after I left town, but if you ask nicely, I'm sure they'll make it for you. Trust me, it's worth it. Another good thing about Rufino Chianti is that it's a great value. In wine, more expensive doesn't always mean better. It's all about what you like. But everybody has a line. In 2012, when I spoke at the House Radio and TV Correspondents' Dinner, the organizer who was introducing me announced that they wanted to get me a nice bottle of wine as a thank you for speaking. But then they remembered the House ethics rules prohibited gifts to members with a value greater than $10. Well, that didn't stop them. They pulled out a bottle of MD 2020, the concoction you find in convenience stores, that's nicknamed Mad Dog, for what it turns you into, and handed it to me right there on stage. It was even the red grape wine flavor. That brought the house down. It really was an inspired and totally legal gift idea. I was laughing so hard I could hardly keep it together, but I think I re-gifted that bottle to my staff. I didn't mind being known as a wine guy. Over the years, whenever someone would ask me if I wanted to run for president, I'd given them some version of the same answer. I like to play golf. I like to smoke cigarettes. I like to drink red wine, and I like to cut my own grass. And if you think I'm giving all that up to be president of the United States, you're crazy. It got a laugh, but I meant it. At least nowadays, nobody's asking me to run for president anymore. I don't even think I could get elected in today's Republican Party anyway, just like I don't think Ronald Reagan could either. Living through the 2020 election was a pretty strange experience, even for somebody who'd been in politics for quite a while. It showed that, in a lot of ways, America only got more divided during the Trump years, but it showed some unexpected glimpses of possible cooperation, too. It was a little surprising to see Biden win the White House while Republicans held their own in Congress and even picked up a lot of seats in the House. Then again, just about every time I was on the ballot during a presidential election year, about 10% of the voters in my district would cast their vote for president and then apparently just walk out of the voting booth, ignoring the rest of the ballot. It seemed like that happened a fair amount in 2020, which meant the voters' decisions came down to one factor, Donald Trump. They had 4 years to watch and listen to him and came to the conclusion that even if they agreed with him on policy, his personality rubbed them the wrong way. And Joe Biden, for all his faults, is basically a nice guy who didn't suffer from his own personality defects the way Hillary Clinton did. At the same time, Republicans actually did better with Black and Hispanic voters than they did in 2016, suggesting a more diverse coalition of voters in the party's future. That was something I was gratified and slightly surprised to see. If the GOP knows what's good for them, they'll work extra hard to reach out to these communities and make the most of these gains. But I'll admit, I wasn't prepared for what came after the election. Trump refusing to accept the results and stoking the flames of conspiracy that turned into violence in the seat of our democracy, the building over which I once presided. Watching it was scary and sad, and it should have been a wake-up call for a return to Republican sanity. And with close divisions in Congress, sane Republicans gained a chance to work with Joe Biden to actually get things done. Biden, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer are all negotiating pros. After all, take it from me, I've been around the table with these guys many times. Whatever they end up doing or not doing, none of it will compare to one of the lowest points of American democracy that we lived through in January of 2021. The mob attack on the Capitol building shocked the nation and killed one of our Capitol police officers. Several others took their own lives days later. Four rioters died as well. Trump incited the bloody insurrection for nothing more than selfish reasons, perpetuated by the bullshit he'd been shoveling since he lost a fair election the previous November. He claimed voter fraud without any evidence, repeated claims, taking advantage of the trust placed in him by his supporters, and ultimately betraying that trust. It was especially sad to see some members of the House and Senate helping him along, although some of the people involved did not surprise me in the least. The legislative terrorism that I'd witnessed as Speaker had now encouraged actual terrorism. And it pissed me off. I called on Trump to resign, but I knew that wouldn't be enough. My Republican Party, the party of smaller, fairer, and more accountable government, and not conspiracy theories, had to take back control from the faction that had grown to include everyone from garden variety whack jobs to insurrectionists. If the conservative movement in the United States was going to survive, there couldn't be room for them. Time will tell how successful that mission will be, but I hope to be able to do my part, even in retirement. In the meantime, I still like to play golf, I still like to smoke cigarettes, and I still drink red wine. But the summer of 2019 was the last summer I cut my own grass. Age has a funny way of catching up with you. That August, after I cut the grass for the last time, I retired my trusty old lawnmower. I found a spot in front of the garage with a bunch of boxes piled up, and I moved the boxes to make some space, pushed the mower in, and put all the boxes back on top of it and buried it, never to be used again. Okay, so I'm not cutting my own grass anymore, but I'm still me. I'm the same jackass when I left the Capitol I was when I first walked in, and I still am today. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that I left on probably the highest of all high notes you could think of, a memory that gave me comfort when carnage overtook the Capitol some years later. I tried for 20 years to get a pope to come visit the U.S. Congress. No luck with John Paul, no luck with Benedict, but by the time Francis was elevated, I had friends in the Vatican who could help the process along. In fact, I understand His Holiness was especially favorably disposed to the invitation I sent him after he learned about the work I and my late pal Ted Kennedy had done for kids at Catholic schools in Washington. When Pope Francis agreed to address a joint session of Congress, I was beside myself. And imagine how wonderful it was to learn later that my daughter Lindsay, who was pregnant with my first grandchild, was set to give birth shortly before the Pope's arrival. I swung into action immediately, leaning on everybody that I'd ever met in the Vatican or anyone else to see if I could get the Holy Father himself to baptize my grandson. Well, the Vatican has a 2,000-year head start on bureaucracy over the United States. But eventually the word came back that it wasn't in the cards. He'd be happy to bless my grandson, but apparently they don't like to let the Pope do baptisms outside of a church. When the big day came, nothing could dampen my excitement. When Pope Francis arrived at the Capitol, I officially greeted him for all the cameras from around the world, then sent them away and escorted him to my office. Then I sat down with just the Holy Father, seven cardinals, and my chief of staff, Mike Summers. Summers, I leaned over and whispered, what the hell are we doing here? For two kids from Catholic schools, this was about as big a deal as it gets. I just hope the Holy Father didn't hear my exact language. We had a lovely meeting. The Pope spoke English well enough that we could carry on our conversation without a translator. As it was breaking up, my family, who had been in an adjoining room, came in to meet His Holiness. As Francis stood up, he turned to his assistant and said, could you get me a glass of water? My heart leapt. There were Lindsay and Dom with Alistair. Maybe he was going to get baptized after all. The assistant brought Francis the glass. The Pope took it, raised it. Was he going to bless it? Oh my God, I think he is. I think he's going to baptize him right here. Then he just took a drink. That was it. It's still one of the most impressive head fakes I've ever seen. He gave a wonderful speech that day. He even said a few lines in his native Spanish, which our Spanish-speaking members loved. Before he left, we found ourselves alone near the door where he was to exit. And before I knew it, he drew me into an embrace and said, Mr. Speaker, pray for me. Holy Father, I said, who am I to pray for you? But I did, and I still do. I'd never seen Congress more happy than it was that day. Republicans and Democrats, senators and representatives, everybody was uplifted by the Pope's visit. And it was the presence of the Holy Spirit he brought there that day that gave me the idea to announce my retirement, not in the fall as I had planned to do, but the very next day. And I've got to say, I love being retired. For one thing, I get to spend a lot more time with my family. We've got 9 siblings to stay in touch with, remember. There will be 11, but sadly, my brother Rick passed away in 2015 and my sister Linda in 2018. I miss them both. None of us are here forever, and we've got to make every day count. But the family's growing, too. Our daughters and our husbands each have a little boy. Lindsay and Dom have Alistair. Trisha and James have Zach. My grandsons are little guys with big personalities, and they run me ragged trying to keep up with them. I've had a bunch of fancy titles over the years, but it's a lot of fun to just be Papa now. It's nice to be able to catch up with old friends. Some of the saddest people I know in Washington are the politicians who got so deep into their work, who only cared about wheeling and dealing, and that they never had time to make real friends. Or if they had them before, they shed them once they got to D.C., and only went after people they could get something from. Politics is full of people like that. I've never resented them, but I did feel bad for them. I'm very lucky to have friends from all stages of life. Guys like Jerry Vann I've known since we were kids. And my best buddies from Congress like Burr, Chambliss, and Latham. And that we can get together or pick up the phone and still give each other shit like no time has passed at all. Deb and I also spend a lot of time in our condo in Florida now. Southwest Florida is a beautiful piece of God's earth. We share it with some of the nicest people you could ever hope to meet. Neighbors and the folks at shops and restaurants who become like family over the years. Most of them came from somewhere else. A lot like Deb and me came from the Midwest and just followed I-75 South until they ran out of road. An exception was Stan Gober, who came from Alabama and ran Stan's Idle Hour restaurant in Goodland until his death in 2012. Stan was a local legend and a great American, and the restaurant is still run by his family and still serving the best grouper on the Gulf. There are other neighbors, too, like the gopher tortoise and the burrowing owl. These little guys were all over the place. You have to be especially careful driving around our neighborhood because the tortoises are a threatened species. And sometimes, as the tortoises do, they like to cross the road. You avoid them if you can, but there are times you have to pull over and get out to give them a hand in getting to the other side. I couldn't cut my grass in Florida even if I wanted to because, well, we don't have a yard. But we do have a deck and a view down the beach in the Gulf of Mexico. We try to watch the sunset out there as often as we can. It's truly amazing. We watch as the sun moves across the sky from December 21st to June 21st. Every night in between is a whole new show. Sometimes it reflects off the clouds or off the water. It's hard to think of a better way to experience the beauty of God's creation. It's enough to bring a tear to your eye. And yes, I still like to play golf. I got a lot more time for it now. Mark Twain supposedly said that golf was a good walk spoiled. I don't agree with that. Twain probably wasn't very good and was just pissed off about it. But I do believe that a leader without followers is just a guy taking a walk. When I was Speaker of the House, I had to be a leader. Sometimes that meant being tough with followers. Sometimes it meant going along with things I didn't agree with because that's what my followers expected me to do. But whenever I stepped onto a golf course, I didn't have to be a leader anymore. I could just be a guy taking a walk. It didn't matter what crazy controversy had engulfed Washington. It didn't matter who was walking alongside me, even if it was the President of the United States. For a few hours, no matter what else was going on, I could just focus on putting that little white ball wherever I wanted it to go. Now I'm a little older, and I walk a little slower. But the free, calming feeling is the same. To this day, every time I step off a golf course, I come away with a little bit smarter than when I stepped onto it. Each course has its own tricks, and even the most familiar spots challenge you to play better than you did the last time you were there. And you can learn something from everybody you've ever played golf with, too. Whether it's a lesson in hard work, patience, humility, or humor. Sometimes it takes an 86-year-old former president jumping up and down, swearing like a sailor at the top of his lungs to remind you that we all need to let the steam off sometimes. And if somebody needs a mulligan after an especially embarrassing shot, remember, it doesn't cost anything to be nice. And no matter how bad you're playing, you just keep your head down and keep moving. After all, it's just golf. You hit the ball, find the ball, and hit it again. And you just keep going. Sometimes you hit a few bad shots, but the ball has to move forward, and so do you. If you stick to that, you'll come off the course secure in the knowledge that you did your best. Sure, maybe you wish some shots had gone better, but you have made the best of it and kept going. The most important thing to remember in golf, in politics, in life, is that if you do the right things for the right reasons, the right things will happen for you. And the right things will happen for this country, too. I have just as much faith in America now as I ever had. Despite all the problems thrown at us, diseases, economic troubles, enemies, foreign and domestic, we're still plugging away. There's a line that's attributed to Winston Churchill that goes, "Americans will always do the right thing," after exhausting all the alternatives. Whether Churchill actually came up with it or somebody else, I've always liked that sentiment. It's true that Americans are the most versatile people God ever put on earth. We're a smart people, a nimble people. We stumble, but we adapt. And it's our commitment to freedom that makes that possible. Freedom means you can be a genius and invent new products that make you millions of dollars and helps millions of people. It means you're free to work your way to becoming the first in your family to go to college. It means you're free to reach as high as you want, no matter where you came from, even if you're a little kid sweeping a bar out in Southwest Ohio. Take it from me. You'll never know where you'll end up. That's freedom. I'll raise a glass to that any day.